Welcome back to Into the Open. This week's episode is titled Open for Whom and features Dr. Catherine Cronin. Dr. Cronin is a strategic education developer at the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education in Ireland. She also happens to be an academic researcher who has inspired and motivated me to continue down my path into the open. Today I got the chance to chat with her about her perspective on equity and accessibility in open education. So let's head to the shores of Ireland and check in with Dr. Catherine Cronin. I'm a bit of a fan, so.
When I started doing my research for my capstone project, I had a really hard time finding a definition for open education that included OEP. And so your definition is the one I stumbled upon, and I leaned into it and probably cited it too much.
You're too kind. Okay, great. Oh, that's nice to hear. But you know, I mean, that's what we all do. You know, you're kind of looking around, you're in new terrain, you find something, and then you do your own thing. And then, you know, people will be citing you, you know, and your work. And, you know, that's just how it goes.
To start with, I'd love to actually hear how you ended up in open education. What sparked this?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I guess I could say my background is in engineering and IT. And I also did an MA in women's studies. So I worked in the IT industry for a really short time. And then I did a variety of work. I worked with the Open University teaching. I did research and taught in, I was living in Scotland. So the OU is all over the UK. So I worked for the OU in Scotland. I taught and did research, a big research project in the area of gender and technology. And I worked as a community educator in Scotland and also back here in Ireland where I live now, mostly with women in marginalized communities. I was deeply steeped, I guess you could say, academically and also practically in critical and feminist pedagogies. And then I moved into working full-time in higher education in the early 2000s. And I kind of brought all that with me, as you do. And I guess I, you know, was someone who questioned and possibly transgressed some boundaries around things like collaboration and assessment, things like that. And I joined Twitter in 2009 and found other people who were questioning and doing different things, and social media was quite young at that time. So I began to connect with other educators who were interested in doing some of those things. So I was aware of MIT's open courseware, but I wasn't really engaged in the OER movement as such. It was really what I would call now open educational practices. So I, you know, about 10 years ago, 2011, 2012, I joined with a group of other educators, Ireland, UK, New Zealand, Spain, and Germany. We were connecting our students. Our students were sharing things openly. They were all creating different kinds of digital media, and we were inviting them to share openly, interact with each other, build and adapt each other's work. So that was really exciting. And then I began, you know, I was speaking with people and extolling, you know, the whole notion of, you know, working in the open this way, in the open web, learned more about OER and the process, and was speaking about other people's work and my students' work. And I realized that there was, you know, at my institution and many institutions, there was not a grounding for this kind of open educational practice. Like, there was nothing that would keep it going after, you know, I or other individual educators would stop teaching in that way. So I started my PhD in 2013 and finished in 2018, because I just thought, okay, well, if I do a substantive piece of research in this, maybe I can be part of that move to embed this, you know, in kind of strategically and in policy and so on, so that it can, you know, that we can work, you know, so many of us collectively working to kind of change the culture of higher education, at least in some small ways.
No, I connect with that completely, because I came into it as a student. So I've never seen that done before. I think that was what was so exciting, is I've never had a project or an assignment quite like that, where I actually could contribute to knowledge building. I felt really empowered by it. But I agree with you, the sustainability of it concerns me, because I had amazing instructors. I had Dr. Roberts and Dr. Brown, who are into that and really pushing for open. But for example, this year they've changed instructors, and they're not they're not doing the press book anymore. They're not creating an OER. So it's like, we had this amazing thing go for 2 years that was really empowering as a student and has continued on into my research, but now it's gone.
Exactly.
So I get a bit worried about the sustainability of it. So fingers crossed we can push some policy. And I think that's why we do so many presentations. We were just at the OEG Global. And I think it's just to be like, this works, I promise. Like, give it a try. Like, please jump into it. So that's exciting that you've worked a lot with students and creating. I think that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's how it started. It was very grounded in kind of open practice. And then... you know, just began to see what some of the gaps were in terms of sustainability and also in terms of, you know, I guess we could talk about this, just kind of asking, you know, what is the impact of this? Where is the impact? You know, are we reaching the people who really need, what open enables and can facilitate? So asking some of those kind of difficult questions. So I work with the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education now in Ireland. And that's a really, you know, it's been a wonderful opportunity to collaborate with people across all the higher education institutions in Ireland. And, you know, Open is growing and just, you know, just being in a position to be able to learn and connect dots and develop what the sector, you know, really needs to support what we call building open capabilities and also developing.
It's a good transition into the next one. That's also why I wanted to chat, is the idea of equity. I feel there's like this overlap. I know people will strain out equity and accessibility, but particularly in Canada, where I live, mm-hmm. we're quite remote. And I see how much impact and just how certain communities could contribute, but I just feel they don't have access to half of this. So I get really stuck with Open because I think this is great. We have all these resources where they're getting created, but I kind of see this whole disconnect with equity and accessibility. So I wondered if we could chat a little bit about that overlap and what you see maybe on your side of the pond and what policies are or what can put in place to help with this.
I admire even just that you're questioning, because that's where this work starts, is asking those kinds of difficult questions, isn't it? Is like, well, who is this working for and who is it not working for and why not and how can we change that? So that's, you know, that's an essential first step. And I would say a piece of work that has inspired me a great deal is the ROAR4D project, which you're probably familiar with. It's research in open educational resources for development. It was coordinated from the University of Cape Town, but it took place in, I think, 18 or 19 countries in the global south. And the whole aim was to understand the uptake and impact of OER in education in the global south. And that was Cheryl Hutchinson-Williams, Patricia Arinto, and a whole host of people. That work was published in 2017, I believe, and you know, in the 4 years since that's been published, many, many more people engaged in open education are asking questions around equity and access and inclusion, and that work addressed those questions, particularly from a Global South perspective. So it was really meaningful and important for me. I remember watching it as it was going on, and as I said, it was published in 2017, I think. But I think the salience has even increased since it was published, because it's a model of this whole notion of how OER and OEP relate to social inclusion and social justice. So there's a model which I share quite often in the conclusion of that report around the levels of social inclusion mapped to OER use. And there's those three levels of social inclusion: access, participation, and empowerment. And we just must look at where we are, because, you know, I could never answer a question like you asked without understanding the context. But the work as developed and as written about by that, you know, that whole team of researchers really teases out, you know, a lot of those issues around their steps. You must have access first, and that enables participation. And from there, we can talk about empowerment. And as I said, you know, the written work, you know, goes into a lot of examples in different locations. But I think that's an exemplary piece of work that just keeps on giving, because, you know, there's so many examples.
It'll be interesting too. I had a chance to connect with a few people from the Global South, so from South Africa, and then even Uruguay is the next one because I lived there. So at least I have those connections. Mm-hmm. And Brazil has always been really inspiring. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see if that and that study, how that would transition to like an indigenous way of thinking, if it could be used as kind of a framework or a structure to get get that going. I agree with you. Access is the first thing. We don't have great internet access in Canada. My access in South America was far beyond and better than what I have here. So I think that's a first step. But once they do have access, and some communities do, it's then how do you bring it in and make sure it is suitable and it works with them? Like it's coming from them. It's not just, here's a bunch of resources. And I saw a really great presentation that had been adapted for, I do believe the resources were designed in the States, but then moved into Uganda. And they hit that roadblock where they didn't have things translated. And the students were actually doing some of the translations for them. Or so that's a big focus. And I'm not really sure how you move forward, especially I automatically think, because I'm based in Canada, those communities up north, how do you get it so that it's, I don't feel like I could just take a bunch of resources up there and be like, all right, let's learn. It's more like, how do you get them creating so it's meaningful and it works for that community?
Yeah, I mean, such a great question. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say, first of all, just, you know, we often say that, you know, open is not a binary, right? It's there, you know, there are shades and ways and it's, you know, it's continually negotiated in, you know, in different circumstances, and access isn't binary either. So that's kind of what you're pointing at there. So, you know, even if something is originally shared online, it doesn't mean that all of the participants who might use that need to be online. You know, at some point, those online resources can be shared with an educator in a setting who then can create offline resources that can then be shared. So, you know, again, it's all very context specific. But what you're talking about, I think, gets back to a lot of the work that's been done in the last few years around social, what's called a social justice framework for open education. So again, Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams and Henry Trotter did work around this, around a social justice framework for OER and OEP. Sarah Lambert has done work around a social justice aligned definition of open education. And they both draw from Nancy Fraser's work around the three, you know, the three different types of justice. Yeah, redistributive, recognitive, and representational. You know, I think many, many more people now are finding that as a useful framework, because adding more resources and allocating resources and creating open textbooks doesn't solve those kinds of issues. If, you know, for example, providing open textbooks, A, if they don't reach the people who need them, B, if the people who they're for are not represented and don't have their fingers on the clay of you know, making those open textbooks. So recognitive justice is about representation and recognition, and then, or recognition rather, and representational is about the people who are marginalized having a voice in those resources and those practices.
I do remember Dr. Roberts, she gave us that framework, Sarah Lambert's framework, really early on in our course, and none of us could really connect with it. We weren't there yet. So I think it takes some time.
And that's a really great point, is that even amongst those of us who are working in open, you know, there are layers of understanding. So I'm learning all the time, you know. So, you know, you don't want to share with someone maybe, you know, a really sophisticated framework if they're just being introduced to open, but you can ask some questions. You know, who has access to this, who's represented, you know, even though you might not share the, you know, the academic papers initially, but you being aware of that work, you know, can ask some important questions so that the work can be directed appropriately, you know, and inform our practice as the people who are contributing to change. It's a mindset, it's an attitude to one's work and how you are in the world. And I think once you can see that, it affects everything you do, you know, doesn't it? So, you know, the orientation towards, you know, equity and social justice is probably the most important thing. So, you know, when I talk about open education with people, I don't usually start with open licensing. I talk about, you know, their work and, you know, what they're doing and inclusion, you know, in the context of their work and what open can possibly enable. So really starting from kind of a values perspective, I think, is the most important thing.
I just found with our project that we were doing at the university, they almost had to, Dr. Roberts almost had to start with an OER because they understood the concept of a textbook. So that was, I always joke and kind of say for her, it was the gateway drug. It was like, I can convince you of a textbook. That makes sense. And then from there, she was able to kind of weave in other values, I would say, of open and weave in open educational practices. Yes. But it's interesting that you'd approach it differently, because I found mm-hmm. She almost had to like put that out there because it was something tangible that anyone even outside of Open and the institution could understand.
That's a great example, because context matters. And, you know, in that context, if that's, you know, if that's the way to open the door and start the conversations, then that's a great starting point. Mm-hmm.
The other one I was curious and wanted to get your perspective on, I've been grappling a bit with the idea of reciprocity. And so with Open, to see it as something that's sustainable, I've got to the stage now, I think when we first started, it was like, okay, I have access to these resources. But I think you hit a certain point where you're like, oh, I should probably give something back, or I need to contribute to this. It's not just all take, take, take. I need to be able to give back. But I struggle a little bit in the position, because I can see other teachers like myself, like, for example, after COVID, I was unemployed. And so for me to create resources and just freely give was like, oh, I kind of feel like sharing is a bit of a privilege. And so I grapple a bit with, I want to be able to give back. And I think it's important to be able to give back and remix for the sustainability of it. But I also get a bit worried about the whole equity involved there, because I don't think it's always feasible to be able to share. Like, when it's a fine line, I think, between like when you are capable and able to give freely. So I'd love your perspective and thoughts on just the idea of it being more of a circle and giving back and how that can be sustainable.
Yeah, you're really lifting the lid on a lot of the complexities around Open there. No, it's a great question. I mean, one of the places that my mind goes when you mention that is just thinking about an individual perspective and then maybe a more systemic or structural perspective. So from an individual perspective, yes, you use, if you're using a lot of Open resources, you want to be able to give back and, you know, in some way. But, you know, given the realities and the complexities of academic labor and the way some of us work or don't work, that's difficult. That can be difficult. In a large sense, I mean, that notion of the commons, I remember when that penny dropped for me, that I was learning and seeing lots of possibilities about how I could teach openly, and penny dropped. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm learning so much because other people are sharing not just their resources, but their thought process, their teaching practices. So I should do that as well. And that's when I started blogging all those years ago. And just that was that notion of reciprocity. But the structural argument is really interesting, because it's, you can take the opposite tack. If you look structurally, the fact that maybe, you know, elite universities in the global north produce so much and, you know, initially used the narrative about educating the world is problematic and is a source of epistemic inequality and injustice. So in that case, I remember getting inquiries from people who were thinking about getting into open education and putting their case together and using words like branding. And that's not really the value, you know, the value set of Open that I ascribe to. You know, what about learning from other perspectives, and particularly perspectives that aren't privileged perspectives, and having that be a two-way, as you say. So again, it's down to context. So individual is one conversation, but structurally, we want to think about possibly enabling particularly people and communities that are marginalized to adapt and share and create. And how can we do that? You know, how can we do that through our work so that we're not always the ones who are populating and giving and kind of reinforcing the values and the priorities of privileged institutions or the global north, or, you know, however you want to describe that.
It's almost, in some ways, I could look into giving back by enabling others to do so.
Learning about the UNESCO recommendations on OER, the first one is about building capacity. And we've interpreted that in the National Forum around building capabilities. And that's borrowing from Sen's work on the capabilities approach and Martha Nussbaum. And, you know, you might be familiar with digital capabilities as a term. Helen Beetham borrowed from the capabilities approach when she started using the term digital capabilities rather than digital literacies, for example. So we're in the National Forum, we're using that with Open as well, because capabilities are a person's abilities in their context, in their social, political, economic, educational context. So it isn't just about what a person can do, but what they're enabled to do, you know, in their particular context. So we want to build open capabilities. So that means, you know, some people, some contexts, some institutions, some geographic regions need different kinds of support, need more support than others. And I think it enables us to take a little more nuanced view.
Okay. So if someone was just starting out, I'm just getting into open, what are some steps I could take? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the questions, having those questions in the back of my mind as far as social justice is concerned. But what are some little steps you could recommend or I could take so that I'm making sure I'm approaching this from a social justice standpoint or from an inclusion
standpoint? The questions, I think, are probably the first place to start. I know that sounds like might be a trite answer, but so what might some of those questions be? Are students or learners involved? How are they involved? Are diversity of learners represented? Are they able to participate? Are diversity of staff consulted, included, able to participate? You know, who's excluded, both in what we're doing now and what we're proposing that we might do? And that's probably one of the most useful questions, you know, because quite often we think of things, we think, oh, this would be great. We could open XYZ or in some way. So in that initiative, who would be included in that? Who might be excluded? You know, and it's just really a thinking exercise. Sarah Ahmed has a great quote about this where she talks about causing questions can be a cause of discomfort and that we almost have a duty to notice who turns up and who doesn't. That's actually our responsibility to notice those things. And then, like you were talking about, the labor that's involved in open. So, you know, there's a care aspect often. So asking questions about that as well. So is the care we as an organization or an institution extending? Is that work being done by just a few people? Who's bearing the burden of the care work? Why is that? How do we equalize that? Another good question, I think, is, are all students and staff able to exercise agency around openness? Sometimes simplistic assumptions are made, like, oh, we'll get everyone to share or something. And that can expose and put some people at risk. So just those kinds of questions about any initiative or any proposed open initiative, I think those are some kind of good questions to engage in with people that you're working with, learners and teachers. And so that's one. And then for anyone, I would say probably familiar with the Open at the Margins collection. That was a collection published last year. And the aim was just to curate and center marginal voices and non-dominant stances. So it's not peer-reviewed work. It's openly published work over the last 10 years or so in the area of open education that asks some of these questions. So it's some great examples of people asking questions about all the kinds of things we've been talking about. There's 43 authors. I was in a wonderful team of 5 people that co-edited it, but the authors are the stars and they're from all over the world. And it's really accessible, not just in terms of being open, but some of them are videos, some of them are short pieces, some of them are a little bit longer, but it's, I know a lot of people have responded to it because of how accessible it is in terms of language and approach and so on. And it just really gets you thinking about what open can be. So I think that's a place to start. And in various ways, people question the power relations around open in those pieces.
A lot of the people I work with right now, professors particularly, are just starting to figure out this whole open. They're still quite hesitant. So is there anything you would say to someone who might encourage them or might kind of ease their concern with open? And
well, that's a great question also. And, you know, I have actually had some of the most, you know, interesting and fruitful discussions around open in the last year and a half, you know, since, you know, in the time of the pandemic, because, you know, as many people have written in one fell swoop, all teachers became online teachers and all learners became online learners. Many more people entered the conversation about digital, online, and open than had been engaged in those conversations before. So I think one of the ways into the conversation, in my experience, is that, you know, we are living in a time of not just change, but crisis, right? The climate crisis, the pandemic, rising and intersecting inequalities globally, but also locally. You know, rising authoritarianism, surveillance capitalism. So this affects teaching, learning, and assessment and living, particularly because, you know, in some cases, the people may be experiencing trauma, you know, in connection with all of these. In other cases, there's just a constant level of stress because if those of us were involved in education, you know, we were teaching face-to-face, we went to teaching online, now we're back. It's a very tenuous, tension-filled space. What are we doing? When will it change? How will I adapt? And so on. So because open education begins and is grounded in the values of accessibility and equity, there's long-standing work, discussions, and examples of work in open education around all of these issues around authentic assessment, equity in assessment, equity in classrooms, inclusion, epistemic inequality, you know, mature, as I said, discussions and strands of work and publications that people can draw on. So it isn't just a new challenge. It's a body of work, you know, where people can go to find people and community and examples of work to deal with the challenges that we're facing today. I think that's probably one of the most convincing arguments for me for people to engage in open. It's not starting with open licensing or open textbooks, although those are immensely valuable, but it's really about recognizing, acknowledging, and dealing with the challenges that we're all facing today. That's the most important thing.
I would agree. For me, starting out, it's been that community. I haven't in academics seen a community quite like the open community. Like, people are willing to connect and share their ideas and really want to push you and support you in growing. And that, to me, and you're right, it comes back to the basic values. But that is what I kind of communicate to anyone who's like, I'm not sure about this whole sharing thing. I don't really like what I can't see. But the community and that sense of belonging touches something a bit deeper than just that surface level sell a course or pay your tuition. It goes deeper into what I think learning is actually about.
And you know, for any individual person that I might engage with about this, it's just, you know, really seeking to understand, you know, what problem are they trying to solve? You know, what are the challenges that they're facing, they and their students or learners that they're working with? And, you know, increasingly, I can point to work in the open education space that addresses, you know, so many of those challenges and problems that people are trying to address. And, you know, as you say, you know, by and large, people working in open education are quite clear-eyed about the challenges that we all face, but also hopeful, and also generally committed to this notion of continually learning, you know, this continual move towards a more critical orientation. You know, has been part of the open movement of the last number of years. So it's continually evolving. And, you know, I think that's a really positive thing. And, you know, when I give a presentation about open education or open educational practices, I usually include lots of examples because I try and give people a toehold into, you know, here's an example of how this is done. And here's a great example, you know, from all over the world. And I always end by saying, please feel free to contact any of the people whose work I've cited, because I can absolutely guarantee you that they'll be really happy to know, A, that you're interested in the work that they've shared openly, and B, will most likely be happy to engage in conversation with you about, you know, what it means to you or what it could mean. So are you, I love the idea of this podcast and, you know, the interesting questions you've posed. So, you know, are you talking to educators and learners? Are you talking to people in different communities and different parts of the world? I mean, what's your intention for the podcast?
What the podcast started out with was I still had a lot of questions and was really just confused about how this could be sustainable, how open could be sustainable, and how it could function and work and thrive or succeed in different areas of the world. And so I wanted to reach out with the people that I've read their work or that might have more insight in specific areas that could help me understand that. And I thought, well, if I do it through a podcast, then others can understand alongside with me or can formulate their own opinions or can contribute to that conversation. So I saw the power in podcasting when I was in the Middle East and COVID hit. I'd never been into podcasts before, nothing. And I got invited to speak with a group of educators out of Asia. And so they had shut down about a month before us. And so I learned, we were just shutting down. So I was able to kind of twist and shift my practice based on their recommendations on what had worked for them and what hadn't. And then South America shut down a month later. And so I was able to send them all of my stuff that had been kind of remixed, I guess you could say, from Asia. And I sent it there and I thought, this is through one podcast. Like, I was able to connect and share. So I thought, there's power in that. And it is accessible. Like, people all over the world can listen or not listen. And so I kind of was like, there's something to podcasting. I don't know what it is yet. But I thought, well, let's give it a try. And Verena was willing to do it.
That's really lovely. You're modeling kind of openly learning and then sharing that. And presumably the conversations will evolve
So hopefully as I learn, I'm able to contribute more to the conversations. So yeah, so hopefully I can get involved in and connect with people that you normally wouldn't, I wouldn't necessarily hear. Because again, when I started, it was hard to even find your definition and dig that out and kind of go over the pond, we say, and look at what's been going on in England connects a bit more with my viewpoints.
Well, I'm happy to be, you know, a voice from Ireland. And, you know, I'm originally from New York City, so I always carry my New York City with me as well. and I'll just look forward to how your conversations continue and evolve. It'll be really interesting.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy and you've got a lot going on, but your work is very inspiring.
You're so welcome. Best of luck with the project, and I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for joining us for this week's episode of Into the Open. Into the Open could not be produced without the wonderful support of the GoGN Network. If you're new to open education or really deeply involved, this is a great place to connect and network with like-minded people. Into the Open is created and produced by Dr. Verena Roberts, Heather Van Struen, and myself, Nicole Knightson. Until next time.